Good evening. My name is Luis Perez Oramas, and I am the Latin American Art Curator here at the Museum of Modern Art. I organized the exhibition New Perspectives in Latin American Art 1930-2006, Selections from a Decade of Acquisitions. The show, which was made possible thanks to the support of Cathy and Richard S. Fult, Jr., and of the Friends of Contemporary Drawing, includes a great deal of works by both modern and contemporary Latin American artists that deal with language, poetry, and texts. Tonight's program is part of the Modern Poets series, which is generously supported by the Contemporary Art Council of the Museum of Modern Art. A long time ago, Paul Celan, one of the greatest poets ever, dared to tell one of the dramatic truths of our times. The poem, he said in 1960 while being awarded with the George Buchner Prize, the poem today strongly leans towards its silence. I like to think that as much as language and poetry are rooted in the visible world, the world of visible things is grounded in language, which actually makes possible its own visibility. It is as if the history of Echo and Narcissus was an endless one, the language being a mirror of languages, the image being a mirror of images. I also like to think that if poetry today tends to lean towards silence, then there are still places in the world where poets embody a public voice, where their words talk the voice of others, as well as everyone else's voice. Latin America could be one of these places. And this is because, to make another paraphrasing of Paul Celan, a poem is not something beyond time. It might pretend to reach the infinity, but it tries to do so by transpiercing time, by going through time, not beyond time. From Jules Solar, the Argentine avant-garde genius who spent his life inventing a universal language, the panlingua, to Ligia Pape, whose book of creation translates the Genesis into abstract geometric language, from Mira Schendel, whose work is rooted in the body of writing and says yes to the world, to Leon Ferrari trying to depict with abstract drippings the Sermon of the Blood by poet Rafael Alberti, from Elio Oiticica producing the monogram of his father's name to Eugenio Didburn, Álvaro Barrios, Vic Muñiz, and Fernando Bryce, all included in the exhibition showing that modern and contemporary artists from Latin America have endlessly dealt with the originary tension between texts and images as if they were, time and again, close to Philostratus, producing images as coded texts, generating texts as hidden images. Pictura poema tacitum. A painting is a silent poem. Simonides' famous assertion that has obsessed artists since antiquity still resounds in our world of fast images, a world that rather blinks than actually sees. Because what we want to say, as Maurice Merleau-Ponty recalls, is not something in front of us that we can conceive beyond words, as if it were pure meaning. Because meaning without words is not the ultimate clarity, but rather the lust of clarity. Poetry has always something to tell us, as well as something to reveal to us. We are glad that Mexican poet Monica de la Torre, as well as the artists Álvaro Barrio and Fernando Bryce, whose works are included in the show, are here to read us some poetry, to tell us about some dreams, to voice some images. And shadows will be amazed at their songs, to quote another poet, Horace, whose motto taken from Simonides still regulates the complex regime of contemporary images. ut pictura poesis, as is painting, so is poetry, or reversely, as is poetry, so is painting. Welcome, Monica, Álvaro, and Fernando, and thank you all for being here with us tonight. I want to add some practical tips about the reading tonight. We asked Álvaro Barrios and Fernando Bryce to bring us poems or poets that they think has impacted their creative process, and we asked Monica to bring us poets that she thinks have been important or instrumental for her production. The reading this evening will be bilingual. You have a program that specifies which poems are read in which language. Monica de la Torre will read the English translations for Fernando Bryce's selection of poems, and Pablo Elguera, the director of adult and academic programs here at MoMA, who is also an artist and a writer, will read the English translation for Álvaro Barrios' selection. Then I hope we will have time for a discussion, a session of questions and answers, and I will moderate the session with the help of Monica and will help Monica with the translations. So thank you very much, and welcome. Welcome, Fernando and Monica.
Good evening. Buenas noches. I have to apologize that I will not speak in English because I feel not too comfortable. Voy a hablar en castellano y leer también en castellano. He seleccionado poemas de Álvaro de Campos, Fernando Pessoa, un heterónimo de Fernando Pessoa, y de César Vallejo. Pues voy a empezar con Álvaro de Campos. Lisbon Revisited, 1926. Nada me ata a nada. Quiero 50 cosas al tiempo. Con la angustia del ávido de carne, anhelo. No sé bien qué. Definidamente lo indefinido. Duermo inquieto y vivo al soñar inquieto. Del que duerme inquieto a medias soñando. Me cerraron todas las puertas abstractas y necesarias. Corrieron las cortinas ante todas las hipótesis que habría podido ver en la calle. En el callejón donde me encuentro no hay el número de puerta que me dieron. Desperté a la misma vida que me había adormecido. Hasta mis ejércitos soñados sufrieron la derrota. Hasta mis sueños se sintieron falsos al ser soñados. Hasta la vida solo deseada me harta hasta esa vida. Comprendo a intervalos inconexos, escribo en los lapsos de cansancio y es tedio hasta del tedio lo que me arroja la playa. No sé qué destino futuro compete a mi angustia sin timón, no sé qué islas del sur imposible son las que me aguardan náufrago, o qué palmares de literatura me darán un verso al menos. No, no sé esto ni de otra cosa, ni sé nada de nada. Y en el fondo de mi espíritu, donde sueño lo soñado, en los campos más remotos del alma, donde recuerdo sin causa, y el pasado es una niebla natural de lágrimas falsas, en los caminos y atajos de las florestas lejanas, donde supuse mi ser, huyen desmantelados últimos restos de la ilusión final. Mis ejércitos soñados, derrotados sin haberlo sido, mis cohortes por existir, despedazadas en Dios. Otra vez vuelvo a verte, ciudad de mi infancia, pavorosamente perdida, ciudad triste y alegre, otra vez sueño aquí. Yo, pero ¿soy yo el mismo que aquí vivió y aquí volvió a volver y a volver, y aquí de nuevo ahora ha vuelto a volver? ¿O todos los yo con los que aquí estuve o que estuvieron, somos una serie de cuentas entes ensartadas en un hilo memoria, una serie de sueños de mí por alguien que hay fuera de mí. Otra vez vuelvo a verte, el corazón más lejano, el alma menos mía. Otra vez vuelvo a verte, Lisboa, y Tajo, y todo, transeúnte inútil de ti y de mí, extranjero aquí como en todas partes, tan casual en la vida como en el alma. Fantasma errante por los salones del recuerdo, envuelto por el ruido de ratas y de maderas que crujen en el castillo maldito de tener que vivir. Otra vez vuelvo a verte, sombra que pasa a través de las sombras y brilla, un instante a fúnebre luz desconocida, y se adentra en la noche cual estela de barco al perderse en el agua que dejamos de oír. Otra vez vuelvo a verte, pero, ¡ay!, a mí no vuelvo a verme. Se ha roto el espejo mágico en el que volvía a verme idéntico, y en cada fragmento fatídico solo veo un pedazo de mí, un pedazo de ti y de mí.
The translation I will read you now is by Edwin Honing, and he's one of the most acclaimed translators of Pessoa. And this poem, Lisbon Revisited, was written in 1926, and it's by Álvaro de Campos, one of Pessoa's main heteronyms. Lisbon Revisited. Nothing holds me to anything. I want 50 things at once. What a meat-hungry anguish, I yearn for what I don't know, definitely for the indefinite. Restless, I sleep and live in the restless dream of someone who sleeps restlessly, half of me dreaming. They closed all the abstract and necessary doors on me. They drew the curtains on all hypotheses I might see on the street. There's no house on the side street with the number they gave me. I woke to the same life I departed by sleeping. Even my dream armies suffered defeat. Even my dreams felt false as I dreamed them. Even the life I only desire, even that life, cloys. I understand in fits and starts. I write between times when I'm not tired, and a boredom that's bored even of itself drags me ashore. I have no idea how the future and fate will treat my aimless anguish. I don't know what impossible southern islands await me shipwrecked, or what palm groves of letters will give me at least a line of verse. No, I don't know this, that, or anything else. And deep in my soul where I dream what I dreamt, in the furthest recess of my soul where I live memory without any reason, and the past is a natural fog of fake tears, on the shortcuts and roads in the faraway woods where I hypothesized my being, the last remnants of my ultimate illusion flee. Dismantled. My dream armies vanquished without ever having been, my latent cohorts shattered to pieces in God. Once again I see you, city of my childhood, terrifyingly lost. City of my sorrow and joy, I dream here again. I? But am I the same person who lived here once and returned and came back here again and again? And now come back here again? Am I? Or are we, all the eyes I was or were here, a string of bead beings strung all together by a memory strand, a string of dreams of myself which someone outside me dreamt up? Once again, I see you, with heart more distant, soul less my own. Once again, I see you, Lisbon, the Tagus, and all, useless passerby of you and of me, stranger in this place as in every other, accidental in life as in the soul, phantom wandering the halls of memory, to the squealing of rats and the squeaking of boards in the doomed castle where life must be lived. Once again I see you, shadow passing through shadows, shining for one moment in an unknown funereal light, then entering that night like a ship's wake, disappearing in water slowly become inaudible. Once again I see you, but myself, alas, I failed to see. Shattered, the magical mirror where I saw myself identical, and in each fateful fragment I decry only a piece of myself, a piece of you and of myself. Okay, sorry. Next poem. in a translation by Richard Sinnath, and it's called Deferral. The day after tomorrow, not until the day after tomorrow, I'll spend tomorrow thinking about the day after tomorrow. And then maybe we'll see, but not today. Today is out of the question. Today I can't. The confused persistence of my objective subjectivity, the fatigue of my real, interminably appearing life, the anticipated and infinite weariness, a multi-world weariness just to catch a streetcar, the species of soul. Not until the day after tomorrow. Today, I want to get ready. I want to get ready to think tomorrow about the day after. That will be the decisive one. I've already planned it out. But no, today, I'm not planning anything. Tomorrow is the day for plans. Tomorrow, I'll sit at my desk to conquer the world. But I'll only conquer the world the day after tomorrow. I feel like crying. I suddenly feel, deep within, like crying. No, don't try to find out anymore. It's a secret. I'm not telling. Not until the day until tomorrow. When I was a child, I was amused by the Sunday circus every week. Today, I'm only amused by the Sunday circus of every week of my childhood. The day after tomorrow, I'll be different. My life will triumph. All of my real qualities of intelligence, erudition, and practicality will be convened by an official announcement, but by an announcement to be made tomorrow. Today, I want to sleep. I'll draft announcements tomorrow. For today, what show is playing that would reenact my childhood? I'll be sure to buy tickets tomorrow, since the day after tomorrow is when I want to go. Not before. The day after tomorrow, I'll have the public image which tomorrow I'll rehearse. The day after tomorrow, I'll finally be what today I could never be. The day after tomorrow, not before. I feel tired, the way a stray dog feels cold. I feel very tired. Tomorrow, I'll explain it to you, or the day after tomorrow. Yes, perhaps not until the day after tomorrow. The future. Yes, the future.
Para responder a la inquietud, la traducción del portugués al español, al castellano, es de José Antonio Lardente. The Times. Se sentó a la mesa borracho y escribió un editorial del Times. Claro, inclasificable, documentado, creyendo, el pobre que iba a influir en el mundo. Santo Dios, tal vez haya influido. Y el esplendor de los mapas, camino abstracto hacia la imaginación concreta. Y el esplendor de los mapas, camino abstracto hacia la imaginación concreta. Letras y trazos irregulares abriéndose a la maravilla. Lo que de ensueño yace en las encuadernaciones vetustas, en las firmas complicadas o tan sencillas y esbeltas de los libros viejos. Tinta remota y desvaída, aquí presente, más allá de la muerte. Lo que, negado a nuestra vida cotidiana, viene en las ilustraciones. Lo que ciertos grabados de un anuncio sin querer nos anuncian. ¿Cuánto sugiere o expresa aquello que no expresa? Todo lo que dice aquello que no dice. Y el alma sueña, diferente y distraída. Oh, enigma visible del tiempo, viviente nada en que estamos.
The next poem was translated by George Montiero. For over a half an hour, I have been sitting at my desk with one purpose, to stare at it. These lines are not in my vein. I, too, am out of sync. The large inkwell in front of me, pens with new nibs in front of me. Closer to me, some very clean paper. To my left, a volume of the Encyclopedia Britannica. On my right, on my right, the letter opener with which yesterday I did not have the patience to open completely the book that interested me and I shall not read. If only I could bring all of this into focus.
Bueno, y ahora continuamos con César Vallejo. Empezaremos con un poema de los poemas en prosa. Nómina de huesos. Se pedía a grandes voces que muestre las dos manos a la vez, y esto no fue posible. Que mientras llora le tomen la medida de sus pasos, y esto no fue posible. Que piense un pensamiento idéntico en el tiempo en que un cero permanece inútil, y esto no fue posible. Que haga una locura, y esto no fue posible. Que entre él y otro hombre semejante a él se interponga una muchedumbre de hombres como él, y esto no fue posible. Que le comparen consigo mismo, y esto no fue posible. Que le llamen, en fin, por su nombre, y esto no fue posible.
Now we're reading poems by César Vallejo. I'm reading translations by Clayton Eshleman. Roster of Bones. They demanded, shouting, let him show both hands at once. And this was not possible. Let them, while he's crying, take the measure of his steps. And this was not possible. Let him think an identical thought in the time that a zero remains useless. And this was not possible. Let him do something crazy. And this was not possible. Between him and another man similar to him, let a crowd of men like him interpose themselves. And this was not possible. Let them compare him with himself. And this was not possible. Let them call him, finally, by his name. And this wasn't possible. This is a prose poem from a posthumous collection, Los Poemas Humanos. No one lives in the house anymore, you tell me. All have gone. The living room, the bedroom, the patio are deserted. No one remains any longer, since everyone has departed. And I say to you, when someone leaves, someone remains. The point through which a man passed is no longer empty. The only place that is empty with human solitude is that through which no man has passed. New houses are deader than old ones, for their walls are of stone or steel, but not of men. A house comes into the world, and when people finish building it, but when they begin to inhabit it. A house lives only off men, like a tomb. That is why there is an irresistible resemblance between a house and a tomb. Except that the house is nourished by the life of man, while the tomb is nourished by the death of man. That is why the first is standing, while the second is laid out. Everyone has departed from the house, in reality, but all have remained in truth. And it is not their memory that remains, but they themselves. Nor is it that they remain in the house, but that they continue about the house. Functions and acts leave the house by train or by plane or on horseback, walking or crawling. What continues in the house is the organ, the agent and gerund and encircle. The steps have left, the kisses, the pardons, the crimes. What continues in the house are the foot, the lips, the eyes, the heart. Negations and affirmations, good and evil, have dispersed. What continues in the house is the subject of the act.
De Poemas Humanos, Salutación Angélica. Eslavo con respecto a la palmera, alemán de perfil al sol, inglés sin fin, francés en cita con los caracoles, italiano ex profeso, escandinavo de aire, español de pura bestia, tal el cielo ensartado en la tierra por los vientos, tal el beso del límite en los hombros. Mas solo tú demuestras, descendiendo o subiendo del pecho, bolchevique, tus trazos confundibles, tu gesto marital, tu cara de padre, tus piernas de amado, tu cutis por teléfono, tu alma perpendicular a la mía, tus codos de justo y un pasaporte en blanco en tu sonrisa. obrando por el hombre en nuestras pausas, matando tú a lo largo de tu muerte y a lo ancho de un abrazo salubérrimo. Vi que cuando comías después tenías gusto, vi que en tus sustantivos creció hierba. Yo quisiera por eso tu calor doctrinal, frío y en barras, tu añadida manera de mirarnos y aquellos tuyos pasos metalúrgicos, aquellos tuyos pasos de otra vida. Y digo bolchevique tomando esta flaqueza en su feroz linaje de exhalación terrestre, hijo natural del bien y del mal, y viviendo tal vez por vanidad para que digan, me dan tus simultáneas estaturas mucha pena, puesto que tú no ignoras en quién se me hace tarde diariamente, a quién estoy callado y medio tuerto.
In the last poem, we'll read, I'll start in English and then he will read it in Spanish. Black stone on a white stone. I will die in Paris in a downpour, a day which I can already remember. I will die in Paris, and I don't budge. Maybe a Thursday, like today, in autumn. Thursday it will be, because today, Thursday, as I prose these lines, I have forced on my chimera, and never, like today, have I turned with all my journey to see myself alone. César Vallejo has died. They beat him, all of them, without him doing anything to them. They gave it to him hard with a stick and hard, likewise, with a rope. Witnesses are the Thursdays and the humorous bones, the lonelinesses, the rain, the roads.
Piedra negra sobre una piedra blanca. Me moriré en París con aguacero, un día del cual tengo ya el recuerdo. Me moriré en París y no me corro, tal vez un jueves como es hoy de otoño. Jueves será porque hoy jueves que proso estos versos, los húmeros me ha puesto a la mala y jamás como hoy me he vuelto con todo mi camino a verme solo. César Vallejo ha muerto, le pegaban todos sin que les haga nada, le daban duro con palo y duro, también con una soga. Son testigos los días jueves y los huesos húmeros, la soledad, la lluvia, los caminos. Los nueve monstruos.
Ese lo vas a leer solo tú en español.
Los nueve monstruos. Y, desgraciadamente, el dolor crece en el mundo a cada rato. Crece a 30 minutos por segundo, paso a paso. Y la naturaleza del dolor es el dolor dos veces. Y la condición del martirio carnívora, voraz, es el dolor dos veces. Y la función de la hierba purísima, el dolor dos veces. Y el bien de ser, dolernos doblemente. Jamás, hombres humanos, hubo tanto dolor en el pecho, en la solapa, en la cartera, en el vaso, en la carnicería, en la aritmética. Jamás tanto cariño doloroso, jamás tan cerca arremetió lo lejos. Jamás el fuego nunca jugó mejor su rol de frío muerto. Jamás, señor ministro de salud, fue la salud más mortal. Y la migraña extrajo tanta frente de la frente. Y el mueble tuvo en su cajón dolor. Y el corazón en su cajón dolor. La lagartija en su cajón dolor. Crece la desdicha, hermanos, hombres, más pronto que la máquina, a 10 máquinas, y crece con las res de Rousseau, con nuestras barbas, crece el mal por razones que ignoramos, y es una inundación con propios líquidos, con propio barro y propia nube sólida, invierte el sufrimiento posiciones, da función en que el humor acuoso es vertical, al pavimento. El ojo es visto y esta oreja oída, y esta oreja da 9 campanadas a la hora del rayo, y 9 carcajadas a la hora del trigo, y 9 sones hembras a la hora del llanto, y 9 cánticos a la hora del hambre, y 9 truenos, y 9 látigos, menos un grito. El dolor nos agarra, hermanos hombres, por detrás, de perfil, y nos aloca en los cinemas, nos clava en los gramófonos, nos desclava en los lechos, cae perpendicularmente a nuestros boletos, a nuestras cartas. Y es muy grave sufrir, pues uno orar, puede uno orar. pues de resultas del dolor hay algunos que nacen, otros crecen, otros mueren, y otros que nacen y no mueren, otros que sin haber nacido mueren, y otros que no nacen ni mueren, son los más. Y también de resultas del sufrimiento estoy triste hasta la cabeza, y más triste hasta el tobillo, de ver el pan crucificado al nabo, ensangrentado, llorando a la cebolla, al cereal, en general, harina, a la sal, hecha polvo, al agua, huyendo, al vino, un eche homo, tan pálida la nieve, al sol tan tardío. ¿Cómo, hermanos humanos, no deciros que ya no puede y ya no puedo con tanto cajón, tanto minuto, tanta lagartija y tanta inversión, tanto lejos y tanta sed de sed? Señor ministro de Salud, ¿qué hacer? Ah, desgraciadamente, hombres humanos, hay, hermanos, muchísimo que hacer.
I will be reading you works mostly translated by myself, except for the first one. It's work that I chose to read because not only I'm very interested in it, but because I think it has a lot of parallels with the exhibition that Luis Pérez Oramas curated. A lot of the poets that I'm dealing with are interested in found text and appropriation. They're very interested in taking the poetry off the page. They're interested in activating the book, mining the book as a convention, and exploring all the different potential that comes from that. They're also very interested in orality and in language as it is used in the public sphere, as opposed to language used in the private sphere of poetry. So I will begin with some images that, unfortunately, this is not the right one, because the first piece I will read, which actually would be the most visual one, I don't have any images for, unfortunately. And it's by Eduardo Costa in collaboration with Hannah Wiener, who is a fabulous American poet that died some years ago, and Jean Perrault. And this text I found in a magazine that Vito Acconci and Hannah and Bernadette Mayer put together from 1969 to 1971. The magazine was called From Zero to One, and it was a mimeographed magazine that contained fabulous collaborations by a number of many different poets, and I was very surprised to actually find the work of a Latin American artist, a conceptual artist, Eduardo Costa, in this magazine, From Zero to Nine. And the work is actually the manifesto for the fashion poetry event that took place in 1969. It took place actually at America Society, what is now called America Society. At the time, it was called the Center for Inter-American Relations. And so they drafted this manifesto and invited people such as Alex Katz, Marisol, James Rosenquist, Klaus Oldenburg, and other people to design fashion based on this text. So hopefully at some point I'll get hold of images that someone here in the audience told me she has. So, the fashion show poetry event essay. It has an epigraph by Octavio Paz. There is no more aesthetic contemplation because aesthetics is dissolving itself into social life. We see the fashion show poetry event not as a time-bounded work of literature, but as the initial cause of a series of events which are a set of translations that add up to a total work. Some of these additional events are the fashion show poetry event number 2, a recreation using videotapes, slide projections, and stereotapes, and the fashion show poetry event book, which will be a documentation in words and photographs, including the text of our fashion description poems, our press releases, magazine articles, etc. It might have been interesting for us to have asked the artists to tell us orally an idea for a fashion garment, and then for us to have written our text without making and showing the real garments. However, some of the reasons we chose to make the effort of presenting an actual fashion show were to move outside the limitations of the printed word, to move away from personal expression, and to present a fictionalized version of a real-life event that would appeal to an audience accustomed to sophisticated perception of visual phenomena. Rather than attempt a union of our three separate styles, we have chosen an objective mass media style. This makes a difference of kind rather than of degree between our present effort and other efforts of literary collaboration. Concerning the total phenomenon of fashion as a language, we would locate the fashion show poetry event in the area of that particular subcategory of fashion language that could be characteristic of the moment of communication between fashion press and fashion show to consumer. Fashion language is a complicated code. It has special meanings within the industry itself, involving the translation of exact equivalents and special meanings when the industry relates to the public. There are various verbal, written, and oral to visual, and visual to verbal translations that take place in the fashion show poetry event. We wish to indicate some differences between translation and communication. In the process of communication, there is a sender, a message, and a receiver. Between sender and receiver, some modification of the message may take place, even though, for instance, the message is in the English language, which is known equally to both sender and receiver. On the other hand, translation is a process of converting a message from one code system to another, from one medium to another, or from language to another. We communicated to the artists our generalized instructions. They translated these instructions into sketches, models, and finally, actual garments. The feedback, i.e., the garments, was then translated by us into fashion language. We have translated this information into the language of press releases aimed at both the general and the fashion press and into the language of the theoretical essay. This process of translation is one of the most important subjects of the fashion show poetry event. The message received by the usual fashion audience and by most of the poetry and art audience as well will be mainly a certain set of meanings. The real message and the message we intend, however, is the game or play or the significance that will transmit an additional set of meanings. There is a difference between a description and that which this description appears to describe. We are interested in this difference. There is a difference between real fashion copy and our poems, which are imitations of fashion copy. There is a difference between a real fashion show and our imitation of a fashion show. We are interested in these differences in spite of the fact that we have tried to eliminate them. We want to show the difference between presentation and representation by bringing presentation and representation as close together as possible. So I find it interesting that by reading that, already another translation process is taking place because you're imagining something that we can't see. Okay, I'm now moving to Brazil, and I'm going to read you poems, one piece by Wally Salomão, who is a man in the middle of this book. The poem is called Ariadnesca, and he was a very close friend of Elio Itizica, and also a very, very close friend of the tropicalista musicians Caetano Veloso and Gilberto Gil, and he remained very close to them throughout his life. He died in 2003, and he was Minister of Books under Gilberto Gil. So when he died, he was Minister of Books in Brazil. So that's his book, published in 1972. And this is the piece. As you can see, that is him, and he is putting a gas nozzle into his mouth. Okay? So, and what he's riffing off is, unfortunately, I don't have very good images for this, but it's Noticias Populares. Noticias Populares was a tabloid in Brazil. So this piece that I'm going to read to you is in the tone of Noticias Populares, the tabloid. And it is called Ariadnesca, as I said, and the headline is, "This man has lived on gasoline since he was 0.7 years of age. He drinks 2 liters a day. Rocky Gomez Mariano, who lives in Itapechinga, has already been news in Noticias Populares. The young man in the photo is the same one of whom we reported in a lengthy article in May 25 of last year that he lives solely on gasoline. Not on rice, beans, or beef. Not on chicken or Neapolitan pizza. What he likes is gasosa, the stinky one that works for automobiles and trucks. Yet, when it comes to taste, to each their own. Socio-secret. Increase the pull of the adjective. Cavernous. Exclusion of the Pharisees. Exclusion of the devotees. Sailors of the water up to their legs, go home. Adventure and concentration. the world's nipples, adventure and concentration, beyond the visible public domain, clan destiny. We were the first to publish the news on May 25th of last year, that is, almost a year ago, Noticia Populares, giving it its due prominence, published the absolutely first-hand story of Rocky Gomez Mariano, the man who has lived on gasoline from his early months of existence on. Beach, a vision of next summer as a site of a disaster. Publicity for a savings account book with a cicada and ant on it. Foundation of a socio-secret called Sparta. A house on a rock, a maintenance and replenishing center. Regeneration of tissues. The perfecting of the power to become invisible. Prayers and rules to become invisible. Rocky Mariano doesn't know what rice, beans, potatoes, vegetables, or any other foods are. When he's hungry, he takes gasoline only. He has never had water. Rocky consumes 2 liters of gasoline and lives in a thatch-roofed house 30 kilometers away from Itapechitinga in the district of Alambari. Seeing water gives him the creeps. He doesn't shower and takes no liquids. His father is an auto mechanic and a widower who lives in a shed next door. Rocky hates his father's company and attacks him if he ever asks to sleep in the same house with him. The phenomenon. Thousands of people, even coming from different states, have tried to come see this phenomenon from Alambari. Rocky delights in drinking or sniffing gasoline on a handkerchief before visitors. Rocky's father tells us that ever since he was a newborn, Rocky had the habit of taking the gasoline spilling from the motorbikes and light vehicles in his shop. The shop supported the family on a regular basis and made it possible for the child, now a gasoline addict, to eat healthy meals. Rocky would bawl profusely every time he was scolded for taking gasoline. So his parents, so as to not have to see him cry, would allow him to drink the gasoline lying about on the shop's grounds. Rocky's parents were afraid that if they took their son's terrible habit away from him abruptly, he could leave the house. He could even try to steal gasoline and cause the family many discomforts. To avoid that, they always let him feed on gasoline. Rocky Mariano was examined a number of times by doctors in Itapechininga and was even admitted to Sorocaba, yet specialists prove unable to explain his strange habit. They have never come up with any cure for the young man either. Of a humble extraction, the father of the unfortunate young man lacks the funds to cover his son's stay at a detox clinic. Yet he'd love for someone to take interest in the case and check the young lad into the clinic's hospital. The baby with a straw. Rocky gets the greatest satisfaction when his visitors actually own automobiles. After asking for permission, Rocky removes the lid of the gas tank and proceeds to suck in the gasoline with a straw. The clinic's hospital could oversee this case, as well as the Ministry of Health, since the man has abnormal behavior that requires correction. Nation. Score to reach. Name. After. Against. Clan. Solidarity. TFP winning all the rounds against the tough gangs. The heavy gangs. Voice of my father, of my mother, of my brothers, of my loves, of my friends, descended over me and occupying any space determining my old age. Rocky's lunch is 2 liters of gasoline. Plurer? No. Exploratory expeditions. To explore is our motto, the fine print, precisely because we need to react against the tearing apart, precisely because at least there are some bodies that I'd rather not see torn apart. Now I'll read you one poem by Ana Cristina Cesar. Ana Cristina Cesar was a marginal poet from Rio de Janeiro. She died in 1985, I believe. And she comes from a generation after Wally Salomão of its young poets who decide to bypass the institutional circuits of publication and literature and literary institutions, and people would perform their poems in the street, would find ways to reach an audience that maybe was gathered to listen to a rock concert or something, and wasn't necessarily expecting to hear poetry. And she was one of the marginal poets. And she's also riffing off the idea of a newspaper as a public site for public information. And as a woman, she decides to riff off that tone and write an intimate daily instead of a public daily. So I'll read you a few lines of these. Intimate daily, June 30th. I find a quote that worries me. Generating contradictions isn't enough. One must explain them. Bit by bit, I say the poem out loud until I know it by heart. Celia appears and confronts me. Her expression makes no sense. June 27. Our first sexual encounter. We were sober. The clouding followed me again. I was unable to make the proper complaints. In Marienbad, I sit next to him. I lost my comb. I deliberately recited capillary fantasies, gibberish, hair rising up my neck. When Binder, from the bathroom, asked what I was saying, I replied, "Nothing," funereally. June 26. Celia also took to criticizing my style at gatherings, ambiguous and overstated. The excesses must have been gratuitous. Binder prefers the hypothesis about seduction. They both act like cats while I'm shook up by Roombas. June 25th. When I was done reading The Garden of Forking Paths, my body was overcome by a rash. We eat duck for lunch. Binder always touches me on the wrong spot. June 27. Only typing made my itch go away. I copied 30 pages of Escola de Mujeres in it's the original without making mistakes. Celia barged into the living room thumping her tongue against her teeth. Celia is an obsessive. June 30th. Celia descended the staircase on all fours. I insisted on the ludicrousness of the act. We eat that fowl again for lunch. I whine and sigh before going to bed. I return to the... Now, I'm going to read you a very brief piece by Juan Luis Martinez from Chile. This, he published a book. He published basically two books before he died. One book was called Chilean Poetry, and it is a box containing dirt, earth from Chile, and the death certificates of poets Pablo de Roca, Gabriela Mistral, and Pablo Neruda. And his next book is called La Nueva Novela, and it's this one. And I'm just going to show you some of this. Okay. Small practical cosmogony. Build a coherent world from scratch, knowing that I equals you and that everything is possible. Make a drawing. Solution one. The loss of the object of desire. The ego's desire to recover the lost object. The ego's identifying with the lost object. In memoriam. Solution two, the new novel. Okay. And then I will just read you one of the following poems. This is called the Page 61, and it appears on page 61 of the book. And if you look at the illustrations, I hope they're legible. Each box has a corresponding note. And you will get the idea when I read you page 99, okay? I won't read you this, but that's page 99, and it appears on page 99 of the book. So I'll begin. A. On page 61, you might have supposed that the people in figure A would have arrived to witness the events taking place on this page. The people are now on figure B of page 61 after having been on this page for a few days. Figure B. The people in this figure are the same ones you encountered in figure C of page 61. Back there, they were returning from having read the foreword. Now you see them back on this page after having reread the book's endnotes. C. Suppose that the people in this third figure are the same that you encountered in figure D of page 61, who back then were somewhere between page 61's figure D and this figure. D. The people you can't find anymore in this figure have left this page and are hastily moving toward page 61. If you've read this book in an orderly fashion, you have encountered them somewhere between that page and this one. E. The author's intention was to wait for the reader to arrive at this figure. But given that he has fallen behind in his reading, the author is again on page 61, waiting for the next reader, who hopefully will be a faster reader and will be able to catch up with him on this page. And finally, I'm going to read you work by Ulises Carrión, who was a Mexican. He started off as a poet, then he became a conceptual artist, was very interested in media. But his first work, he did a lot of work using televisions and video, but his first work was plagiarism of Golden Age poetry. And so this is a model. This is not Golden Age, but it's a poem by Gonzalo de Berceo, a classic Spanish poem. And then he would do this. And this was part of a series called Functions. So then you have verbo, preposición, artículo, sustantivo, adjetivo, preposición, sustantivo. And it's basically just parsing out the poem grammatically. He did another series called Punctuation, and ended up with this. And I'm just going to read you one example of another one called Rhythms. It's a series called Rhythms. The poem is by Juan de la Encina, and the poem is this. Montesina era la garza y de muy alto volar. No hay quien la pueda tomar. Mi cuidoso pensamiento ha seguido su guarida, mas cuanto más es seguida, tiene más defendimiento. De seguirla soy contento por de su vista gozar. No hay quien la pueda tomar. So what he did for the rhythms is this, and I will just give you one example. Ta 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 ta.
Sueños con Marcel Duchamp. Soñé que hacía mucho tiempo habíamos muerto todos y unos artistas hacían sus obras con los huesos de los artistas muertos. Uno de ellos usaba el polvo del rostro de Marcel Duchamp como maquillaje para sus propias mejillas. Con el polvo de las manos de Leonardo, otro artista hacía polen artificial para empolvar las patas de las abejas, etc. La obra más linda era la del Museo del Louvre, donde artistas voluntarios barrían el piso de mármol con virutas del fémur de Gauguin y Van Gogh, quienes en vida fueron tan amigos.
I'm going to be reading a translation of Álvaro Barrios' Dreams with Marcel Duchamp. We're going to be doing Spanish, English, and in some instances only Spanish, only English. I'm now going to read the translation of this first dream. I dreamed we all had died a long time ago, and some artists were making their works of art with the bones of dead artists. One of them was wearing Marcel Duchamp's face powder as makeup for his own cheeks. Another artist was using Leonardo's hand power to prepare artificial pollen for bees' legs, and so on. The most beautiful work was the one from the Louvre, where volunteer artists swept the marble floors with shavings from the femur of Gauguin and Van Gogh, who were close friends.
Soñé que yo tenía 2 años, y Marcel Duchamp había inscrito como arte mi cochecito de pasear, mi babero y una ventana de mi casa que daba sobre un mar perfectamente azul y tranquilo. Años más tarde, el cochecito fue arrojado al fuego, mi babero destrozado por un perro furioso, y la ventana fue colocada en un hospital desde donde se veía un muro gris cubierto de humo. Soñé que yo me encontraba perdido en una misteriosa región en la que Marcel Duchamp tenía la forma de una piedra plateada. Y tuve también muchos otros sueños, como el de la luciérnaga que solo sabía decir Duchamp. Pero el sueño me vence, y quizá algún día los cuente rodeado de nietecitos en un museo donde solo se exhiban artistas viejos, pero vivos.
I dreamed 5,000 years had gone by, and art was already a forgotten thing. Where the Philadelphia Museum of Art is today, there was an automobile workshop, and the Peggy Guggenheim collection in Venice rested at the bottom of the Grand Canal, frozen permanently by a rich man who had bought the city.
Soñé que era el otoño de 1923 y Marcel Duchamp había golpeado con un martillo su gran vidrio después de decirle, habla. Se supone que Duchamp me regaló los pedazos, pues años más tarde aparecí en el sueño cubriendo con esos vidrios un muro de mi casa en Bellavista, donde algunas veces, no sé cuántas al año, un hombre desconocido se cortaba las venas. Soñé que yo me encontraba perdido en un día del lejano futuro, como arrojado allí por una máquina del tiempo, observando el interior de una casa en cuya sala, pobre y sencilla, una mujer usaba el cuadro Río al anochecer con árboles en la orilla, de Rembrandt como mesa de planchar. Soñé que Marcel Duchamp había inscrito como obra suya cada grano de arena del desierto de Gobi, a donde peregrinaban los coleccionistas para adquirirlos. Cuando todos los coleccionistas del mundo retiraron todas las obras, quedó al descubierto una inmensa lámina de cristal gris, nunca antes imaginada por los arqueólogos.
I dreamed that I was at the Museum of Beaux-Arts in Brussels, contemplating the landscape with the Fall of Icarus by Bruegel the Elder, with its fascinating ocean of deep indigo blue, and trying to understand it. When I woke up, I wondered what all this might have to do with Marcel Duchamp.
Soñé que yo estaba en una sala de la Pinacoteca de Múnich, absorto en la Batalla de Alejandro de Albrecht Altdorfer, en cuyo cenit está suspendida una pesada losa de piedra sobre las nubes resplandecientes que se extienden hasta el infinito. Napoleón quedó tan fascinado con esta obra que la instaló en su baño para meditar sobre ella mientras se bañaba. Después soñé algo, no recuerdo qué, sobre Duchamp. Soñé que muchos siglos después de hoy, los niños elevaban cometas hechas con originales de cuadros famosos. Dos niños amenazados por un ruiseñor de Max Ernst volaba junto a Niña comiéndose un pájaro de Madrid. Los pájaros del cielo se posaban tranquilos en las cuerdas de las cometas, que eran fragmentos de la escultura de viaje de Duchamp.
I dreamed that all the ancient paintings had gathered together one day in a park in New York. The bulls of the Altamira caves were telling the unhappy ready-made by Duchamp, leaf-stripped by the wind of 1919, Truly, the years fly.
Soñé que las obras inmortales del arte habían ido juntas a visitar un cementerio de obras mortales. Las puertas del paraíso, de Lorenzo Ghiberti, perdieron el control ante la tumba de El inconsciente azul, de Jackson Pollock. Fuente, de Duchamp, oraba frente al panteón donde fue enterrada Luna de Cadillac, de Jean-Michel Basquiat. La Samaritana dialogando con Cristo, de Jean Cousin el Viejo, destruida en 1775, lloraba junto a la tumba de El tiempo no tiene orillas, de Marc Chagall.
I dreamed that the painting Wrinkled Offering by Paul Klee was holding a grand masquerade for other abstract paintings. The painting With the Black Arch by Kandinsky went disguised as Little Solitude at the Center of the Suns by Francis Picabia. Sonia Delaunay's Electric Prisms was dressed up as Red House Among the Apple Trees by Marcel Duchamp. Untitled by Robert Motherwell was disguised as I Have Something for You to Eat in the Kitchen, Dear. I Am Not Hungry, Mother, Please. I Just Want to Go to My Room by Lichtenstein.
Soñé que todos los cuadros abstractos visitaban a todos los cuadros figurativos un día en Nueva York. El cuadro La Primavera de Marcel Duchamp le decía al cuadro Mundo de Ágata de Mark Toby. Lo esencial ahora no es disgustarnos, sino usar los unos las alas de los otros. En tanto, Joven Triste en un Tren de Duchamp le decía a Composición Inacabada con Amarillo, Rojo y Azul de Piet Mondrian: definitivamente el arte no se hizo para nosotros.
I dreamed that Peggy Guggenheim's tomb in Venice and Marcel Duchamp's in Rouen were connected underground. After all, said Marx Ernst in the dream, no distance is meaningful to the dead.
Soñé que por cierta emergencia el mundo había sido evacuado y cada museo en la prisa había dejado sus obras de arte regadas en distintos lugares. El Louvre en la Plaza de la Concordia, el Museo Victoria y Alberto en el Canal de la Mancha, y así sucesivamente. Cuando todos nos íbamos, el Gran Ver nos hacía señales de luz con el reflejo del sol tirado en las dunas del desierto del Sahara. Soñé que Marcel Duchamp había tapado con bolitas de carne todos los ojos de todas las vírgenes de Tiziano. Soñé que Picasso había arrojado pintura azul en todos los cuadros de su período rosa y luego había arrojado pintura rosa en todos los cuadros de su período azul después del terrible error de una enfermera que le inoculó el virus Marcel Duchamp.
I dreamed that Picasso had thrown blue paint in all the paintings of his rose period, and rose in all the paintings of his blue period, after a terrible mistake of a nurse who injected him with the Marcel Duchamp virus.
Soñé que Marcel Duchamp había inscrito como arte todas las pinturas malas que se habían pintado en el mundo. Al ingresar al Museo Duchamp del Arte Malo, el cuadro Un Puerto, de Bernard Buffet, le decía a Payaso de Rouault: ¿y a ti por qué te escogieron para este museo? A lo que este respondió: calla, calla, yo solo he venido a verlos entrar a ustedes. Soñé que la casa de Salvador Dalí le decía a la casa de Marcel Duchamp: si supiera usted cuánta agua ha pasado bajo mi puente. A lo que la segunda respondió: pero no imagina usted cuánto puente ha pasado bajo mis aguas. Soñé que el virus Marcel Duchamp le decía al virus de Grecia antigua: tumbemos el Partenón de Atenas y hagamos una réplica con queso parmesano. Soñé que un crítico famoso se había suicidado cuando supo que la obra Hombre vestido de turco de Rembrandt no había sido pintada por Marcel Duchamp. Soñé que en la exposición Maestros holandeses del siglo XVIII, que se realizó en Nueva York en 1925, tuvieron que incluir a Marcel Duchamp debido a la influencia de una mujer de mucho mundo que lo ubicaba en esa época.
I dreamed that a queen had acquired Duchamp's fountain for the bathroom of a very learned cook who set the requirements for working in Buckingham's palace. I dreamed that they were selling Marcel Duchamp's ice cream all over, which consisted of vanilla ice cream with Marcel Duchamp's hair inside.
Soñé que la pintura Desnudo bajando una escalera estaba siendo exhibida en la estrella Epsilon del pájaro indio, a 11 años luz de la Tierra, como señal para que un eventual viajero supiese de nosotros. Soñé que el tríptico de la capilla de los limosneros de Amberes había sido pintado originalmente por Marcel Duchamp en un palito de canela, un ala de mariposa y una zanahoria, y luego ampliado por Bernard van Orly sobre una tabla cubierta de oro para que los colores fueran más nítidos y estables. Soñé que el cuadro Parábola de los Ciegos, inspirado en el capítulo 15, versículo 14 del Evangelio según San Mateo, que dice: si un ciego guía a otro ciego, acaban cayendo los dos en el hoyo, había sido pintado originalmente por Marcel Duchamp sobre una córnea y ampliado posteriormente por Bruegel el Viejo para denunciar la ceguera de su siglo. Soñé que Picasso, Matisse y Duchamp subían por el Gólgota con sus cuadros a cuestas. Tengo sed, dijo Picasso. Todo está consumado, dijo Matisse. Hoy estarás conmigo en el paraíso, dijo Duchamp.
I dreamed that some apostles were gathering famous paintings from a stormy sea. The painting, Church at Blainville by Marcel Duchamp, was being used as a sail for the ship where the fishermen were sailing. That day, the fishing was so abundant that 5 museums of the world could be filled.
Soñé que el filme Sueños que el dinero puede comprar, de Hans Richter, rodado en Nueva York en 1945, fue realizado con el fin de que el público comprara mis sueños con Marcel Duchamp.
I dreamed that no one could dream, and so Marcel Duchamp elaborated every person's dream according to their necessities. Each one of those dreams had the possibility of being true.
Soñé que el huracán Alma era el alma de Marcel Duchamp. Soñé que Marcel Duchamp había inscrito como obra suya todo el universo, incluidos todos los planos y dimensiones del universo, y un coleccionista muy rico había venido al universo para comprarlo. Soñé que Marcel Duchamp había declarado arte todo lo que existe, y acto seguido había declarado que solo lo que no existe es arte.
I dreamed that Marcel Duchamp had declared all the world's foolishness intelligent, including this, and then had declared foolish everything that is intelligent in the world, including this.
Soñé que Marcel Duchamp había declarado inteligentes todas las tonterías del mundo, incluida esta, y luego había declarado tonto todo lo inteligente del mundo, incluido esto.
Well, thank you very much. I think we can open a session of questions and answers. I'll throw the first one, and I think it could be while you hope you have some questions or remarks. Well, I think it would be nice if you can tell us a few words of why did you choose what actually was read today. I mean, I have the impression that Fernando has a relationship with these poets. Monica took a more curatorial approach mm-hmm. to the reading, and obviously Alvaro did a performance with his dreams, and probably he can tell us a little bit about Marcel Duchamp. La idea sería entonces que nos digan ustedes un poco antes de abrir la sesión al público un poco por qué escogieron lo que fue leído. Creo que Fernando tiene una relación muy especial con los autores que leyó, con Vallejo y Pessoa. Mónica nos iluminó con una aproximación más curatorial a la lectura y por supuesto Álvaro nos hizo un performance sobre sus o con sus sueños sobre Marcel Duchamp. No sé quién comienza, Mónica. Fernando.
I chose the material that I chose to read because a lot of the work in your exhibition seems to be capitalizing on the potential of text to become art. And the work that I chose is doing the reverse. It's coming from poetry. It's poetry that aspires to inhabit space in the way that three-dimensional work in visual arts inhabits space. So it's work that aspires to that. And basically, that's really why I chose that. But also, I mean, there are some connections between some of the artists in the exhibition. In concrete terms, I'm thinking, for instance, of Sildo Mireles's work mm-hmm. and Wally Salomão's. Mm-hmm. Wally, the book that I showed you, actually, the cover for the book that I showed you was it was very interesting because it was published in 1972. It's a very subversive book, to a degree. It's very coded, but because it's very coded, it's able to appear innocent. And this book was a bestseller that was distributed in every single newsstand in Brazil. And so it's riffing off of Noticias Populares, for instance, but it's being sold in the same circuit. So in a way, I thought of the connection between the intervention in ideological circuits, and this book is really that. And it's going both ways because it's having poetry intervene in popular news, but also popular news intervene in the realm of poetry, for instance. So that was one connection. Mm-hmm. And there's more, but I would like to hear what they have to say.
Thank you, Monica. Fernando, ¿quieres decir algo?
Sí. Bueno, en verdad, cuando me propusieron leer poesía, ¿no es cierto? Me di cuenta que hacía tiempo que no leía. Entonces, poesía hace más o menos 10 años, pero sí leía antes bastante poesía. Sobre todo cosas bastante antiguas. De hecho, los dos autores que he elegido son autores que obviamente me gustan mucho, pero que ya son de época, ¿no? Es decir, eso no les quita que puedan ser muy actuales también, pero son de una determinada época, ¿no? De principios del siglo XX, ¿no? Los dos mueren además en los años 30, ¿no? Y dentro de las cosas que yo he leído de poesía, generalmente, bueno, muchos del siglo XIX, ¿no? De los franceses, todo eso siempre me gustó. Y cosas, bueno, autores latinoamericanos, ya a partir de los 60 algunas cosas, pero en general no leía mucho. Bueno,
hay mucha poesía en América Latina, en Perú, siempre hay cosas muy interesantes, pero en verdad he sido un lector de poesía de cosas un poco más antiguas, ¿no? Y nada, pues dejé de leer de poesía hace como 10 años, como te digo, para mí fue una ocasión para revisar un poco todo lo que habías leído. Y nada, entonces Vallejo, digamos que vi también muchas cosas que había leído del surrealismo, ¿no? Inclusive algunos autores peruanos como Westphalen o César Moro, que son extraordinarios. Pero de alguna manera, releyendo a Vallejo, me di cuenta que hay una especie de contundencia, hay algo ahí con la palabra, ¿no? Que no es, bueno, hay cosas también preciosistas que son muy, hay esa cosa un poco deslumbrante, ¿no? Para hablar de la cosa de los años 30, del surrealismo, que es fascinante, pero en Vallejo hay una cosa donde la palabra como que se vuelve una realidad, ¿no? Autónoma, y al mismo tiempo hace también referencia al mundo, digamos, ¿no? Hay algo ahí que, ¿no?, que hay como una tensión en todo eso que bueno, leí eso y dije, no, esto es, ¿no? Y empezó un poco lo mismo, pero digamos con otro tenor, otra... digamos, empezó a esta especie de nihilismo apacible, ¿no? Que es muy distinto de la cosa de Vallejo, pero finalmente también hay una tensión adentro que hace que sean más o menos, que tengan cosas similares, ¿no?
Well, I'll try to translate the answer for you, and Monica, you will probably complement my translation. Now, this is going to be a synthesis of what Fernando just said. He said that when we invited him to come to read poetry, he realized that he had read a lot a long time ago, and that he had not read poetry for a while, for like 10 years, and then he started to review, to rethink of what he had read in the past 19th century poetry, a lot of Latin American poetry from the 20th century, the 60s, and then he also reviewed some Peruvian poets. I mean, so there is a great tradition of poetry, modern poetry in Peru, and he mentioned Emilio Westphalen and César Moro, who are two surrealist poets in Peru. And then he said that suddenly he... By rereading Vallejo, who is probably the major modern figure in Peruvian poetry, he realized that there was a kind of convincing dimension in Vallejo, and sort of something that makes that the world becomes reality in Vallejo, that there is also a more enlightened or beautiful dimension in his poetry, and then that was finally fundamental, and that finally he had to choose Vallejo. And then that at the same time, Pessoa, more or less for the same reasons, although what interested him in Pessoa was the fact that, let me remember Pessoa.
Nihilism? Yeah, and nihilism,
a kind of peaceful nihilism, mm-hmm. A kind of peaceful nihilism, exactly, and a very kind of strong tension and within the poem and the writing, and that's mm-hmm. mostly the reasons from many of these selections. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Álvaro.
Sí, este programa del MoMA, Poetas Modernos, tiene una especie de subtítulo que diría algo así como Imágenes y Palabras Vueltas a Contar. Y sentí que era muy apropiado en relación con el trabajo que yo he hecho desde el principio de mi carrera, que es precisamente una reinterpretación del arte mismo o una meditación acerca del arte. Y que me ha servido para realizar no solo fantasías acerca de cómo me hubiera gustado a mí que hubiera ocurrido la historia del arte, sino también para hacer crítica de arte, curaduría, teoría, etc. De manera que encontré pues una gran oportunidad para leer una selección de la obra Sueños con Marcel Duchamp, que en su conjunto está integrada por 100 textos diferentes, escritos a partir de 1980. Una parte de esos están en la exhibición actual del MoMA de arte latinoamericano, curada por Luis, y pues en realidad se leyeron unos 37 de estos textos. De manera que pues, antes de que se exhibieran por primera vez en Colombia y luego en otras partes, nunca tuve la pretensión de que pudieran ser poemas. Un poeta colombiano me hizo la observación que le habían gustado mucho, pero que solo había algo que no le gustaba nada, y era que no los hubiera escrito él antes. Entonces ahí empecé a meditar acerca del carácter poético de las cosas, aunque se escriban, se pinten, se hagan, se estornuden, etcétera, sin pretensión de que sean obras de arte o poemas, y que terminan siéndolo, porque tienen ese carácter interior que las compromete ineludiblemente con la poesía. Entonces, eso es lo que les presenté esta noche.
Thank you, Álvaro.
¿Quieres
try?
Como quieras. ¿Sí? Okay, so he chose to read these works there that he has been writing since 1980. There's 100 of them, and he chose to read only 37. What they are they allowed him not only to exercise his fantasy, but to, in doing that, retell the story of contemporary, of modern art in the way that he would like to tell the story. And in writing these, he sees he's performing a historical, critical, and curatorial intervention in these works. He didn't intend them to be poems in the least, but he showed them to a literary critic in Colombia whose one comment was, what I don't like about them is that I didn't write them. And so then he realized that maybe there was something there, and he realized also a parallel between works of art that are done with no pretension for them to be works of art and these poems that actually were poems because they weren't trying to be poems.
Well, now I wonder if you have questions or remarks, and we'll be happy to answer them.
Hay alguien allá.
Sí. There is a micro coming. Okay.
I have what I'm sure is an unfairly general question that picks up on something that Monica Della Torre mentioned, and that is the potential for social disruption, or the limits for social disruption in words and images or poetry and art. And my question, that general question then, is how do you see that potential or those limits weighed out during the, let's say, during the period covered by the exhibition? And to what extent might we attribute the importance of words in that show to those capacities or limits for social disruption?
It's a question that is addressed to
whoever wants to remark upon it, I suppose.
Well, since you address in your question the exhibition, well, it's a very general question. Obviously, it's enormous, as because the exhibition covers in a non-chronological way a period that goes from 1930 to 2006. I would say that there are clearly moments in that period when what you call the potential for social disruption of writing and poetry was actually grounded in the artistic production. One is, I think, the period of concrete poetry in Brazil. And although it is not very visible in the exhibition, one of the major concrete poets is represented, who is Willy de Castro. Then there is a selection of works by Mira Schendel, who was a poet, and who, although she didn't participate directly to the neo-concrete movement, was kind of a critical figure framing what was happening in Brazil since 1948 to the moment she passed away in 1988. And her work is absolutely based on the efficacy of writing and texts. Then I think the neo-concrete movement in the brink to become Tropicalia, it's also another moment. And then I'll mention two figures who are represented: Jules Solar, who is a major figure in the sense, I mean, of the avant-garde in Latin America, and a very close friends to with Jorge Luis Borges, and some of Borges's texts, some of most important Borges's texts are based or directly refer to Jules Solar, with his idea of inventing a panlingua, a total language. And then Leon Ferrari, who is not represented with his written paintings, mm-hmm. which we are about to acquire, or we have already acquired, but and I hope we will show soon, but whose drawings are directly related to writing, and whose work is absolutely framed by in that case directly the political and critical potential of writing. And I would say that Fernando is an example, and Álvaro obviously in a more contemporary chapter of the exhibition, of artists who are disrupting perception and reality through the inclusion of text in their works, in kind of a two extreme opposed possibilities, by appropriating documents in the case of Fernando, and that probably is something that has to do with the heteronomic dimension of Pessoa, and by inventing a kind of weird art history centered on Marcel Duchamp in the case of the dreams by Álvaro Barrios. I don't know if you want to, si ustedes quieren añadir algo sobre el asunto de la potencia disruptiva, de la potencia de perturbación social o de que puede tener la escritura y la poesía en el arte de ustedes, en, mm-hmm. también en tu poesía, mm-hmm. Mónica, mm-hmm. o en
bueno, si quieren, en lo que piensan en su respuesta. I was thinking of, for instance, the book by Juan Luis Martínez, of which I showed you a very small portion, but it deals with that subject in a very interesting manner, because it really is exploding the gap between the image and the image as illustration of the text and the text as caption of the image. Like it's really demonstrating that is where manipulation and interpretation and control occurs. And so that book is full of instances in which it is very palpable that zone that is the most quiet zone of the book, because it's empty, is where politics is happening. And it's a book also that's very, I mean, if you look at the date in which it was published, now I don't have my notes with me, but I think 77, and the book is full of disappearances. The characters cannot be placed in the book, and then there's phrases that ask you to draw a house or draw something that you can never place. The book is not really occurring on the page. It's occurring in space, because it's your answers to his questions that are writing the book. But in a way, all the disappearances are referencing that particular historical moment of Chile. He doesn't need to name it, because had he named it, he would have been illustrating the social context, and he was writing a book of poetry, but it's clearly informed by that.
Mm-hmm. Sí, bueno, en verdad, para regresar a lo que decías de Pessoa, lo de los heterónimos y toda esa cosa, ¿no? Sí, pero es algo más particular. Es decir, en mi caso, claro, por tu lado, sí, me esta cuestión nihilista pasible, que es lo que me parece esta poesía de Pessoa, identifico un poco con eso solamente en una cuestión, digamos, muy como te digo, de, es como un, una disposición, ¿no? Es, un, es como una disposición, es como ese poema que está frente, no digamos el lugar común de la página en blanco, ese tipo de cosas, pero simplemente una especie de estar más bien en blanco, de alguna manera en la cabeza. Entonces, luego viene lo que es la práctica, ¿no es cierto?, de empezar a hacer algo, las cosas, y en mi caso, yo empecé a dibujar, digamos, la primera serie que hice, por ejemplo, que va un poco en el sentido de lo que estoy trabajando ahora, fue pues así como de casualidad, ¿no? Claro, no existe la casualidad en ese sentido, pero digamos que encontré algo en la biblioteca, un panfleto, me gustó, y dije, ¿por qué no lo copio? Entonces lo copié con tinta, ¿no? Y me gustó el resultado porque es como, era como una, o sea, era una copia, digamos, pero todavía no había pensado en ese momento, digamos, al nivel de apropiación, así, conceptualmente, ¿no? Sino más bien me gustó el resultado y claro, es una apropiación efectivamente, pero cuando esto ya como se fue desarrollando, me vi de pronto que estaba como escribiendo. Sí, claro, son dibujos muy clásicos de alguna manera, pero siempre el texto y todo esto, y ahí está como un doblaje, ¿no? Que es como un doble siempre. Entonces, esto de la apropiación en verdad pasa por esa, no es un ritual tampoco, es una práctica nomás, ¿no? De la escritura, de la copia, etcétera. Entonces, más bien, para mí es como un recorrido, ¿no? Es un recorrido a través del cual hay un resultado, que es este trabajo, ¿no? Digamos, es un poco mi acercamiento a mi objeto, digamos, ¿no? Y claro, bueno, y el material es... son discursos, ¿no? Son construcciones, ¿no? Y ahí está un poco el meollo del asunto en lo que hago con relación a la escritura.
Well, he was saying that a little bit reacting to my suggestion that there is a link between the heteronomic dimension in Pessoa and his own work of appropriations and reproductions of documents, and he was kind of explaining the way it started a little bit by chance, although he says there is no chance, and he was saying that there is a moment, comparing that with this, although he says it's a commonplace, the blank page, the white page, the blank page before just you, this kind of augmentum before starting writing a poem, but saying it kind of an exercise of being in blank mind. And then he says that the first one was kind of an accident. He found a pamphlet, he found a poster, and he reproduced it, and he liked it. But he says it's something that goes through a practice. It's not, obviously there is this quality of drawing vis-a-vis the document that is reproduced, but he says it's something that goes through a practice, and at the moment he has not thought of it as a system. I would add that we have, in the case of Fernando's work, we have now a system, almost an encyclopedia of the history as it was. And in the case of Alvaro, we have exactly the opposite, the history as it has never happened. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we have probably the last question. I was told to... was told that we have to leave the... Is that... Laura, do we have a...
We have time for one more question.
Okay, thank you.
Pero, sí, sorry. No sé si Álvaro quería añadir al tema que estábamos discutiendo. Perdóname, Álvaro.
Sí. Sobre la pregunta, la última pregunta que se hizo, acerca de... Tengo entendido que era sobre el poder... de el texto en las obras, ¿no? El poder de perturbación social. Por supuesto que yo creo que es cierto que tanto los textos como la palabra hablada tienen un gran poder de cambio en el mundo desde tiempos inmemoriales y también en el mundo presente. Por eso estoy convencido de que los artistas que empleamos textos en nuestras obras tenemos un compromiso muy claro respecto al contenido de las mismas y el efecto que van a producir no solo en la sociedad, sino en el arte mismo. De manera que, teniendo en cuenta que los grandes cambios de la humanidad, algunos de los más importantes han sido a través de las palabras escritas o habladas, observo que en mucho del arte contemporáneo, cuando hay palabras insustanciales, pues no tienen esa fuerza ni ese contenido que los que hagan que esas obras trasciendan. Y cuido mucho eso en mi trabajo porque sí pienso que me gustaría que fuera un trabajo subversivo en el buen sentido del término, un trabajo que cambie la manera de ver el arte y la manera de disfrutarlo también. Eso.
He says that he acknowledges the potential of transformation that words and he makes a distinction. I think it's a very important distinction: the potential of transformation that written words and words and voiced words and the voice has and had had since always to change the world. And to contribute to change our perception of the world. And then he's very careful to that dimension in his work, that he is he thinks that the artist, as he is, who work with text, are very committed to the content of those texts, and because he absolutely thinks that there is a power of transformation in the use of texts and in the word, in the written word and in the voiced word. And then he adds that sometimes he has the impression that in a great deal of contemporary art, or sometimes in contemporary art, when there are unsubstantial words or void words, then the art loses that that capacity. And he thinks that definitely he would love to see his work, he would love to think of his work as something that can change not only the way we see things, the way we perceive, but also not only the world, but also the art, and that he definitely thinks and believes on that dimension. One more question? Last? Well, I guess this is the end of it. Thank you very much. Thank you, Monica, Alvaro, Fernando. Thank you, Laura and Pablo, and thank you to you all for being here with us. Thank you very much. Thank you.